93. Second Wind. Never in his life had Inakenti experienced such an interminable night. He was wide awake all night long, and a chaotic jumble of thoughts thronged his mind, more than would occur to a man in a month of untroubled normality. There had been time for reflection during the leisurely unpicking of the gold facings from his diplomatic uniform. Then, while he was sitting half-naked in the shower room, and in the various boxes he had been moved to in the night. Keep permanently. Apt words for his epitaph. In fact, whether or not they could prove that it was he who had made the telephone call, now that they had arrested him, he would never be released. Stalin's paw, he knew, let no one escape alive. He faced either execution or solitary confinement for life in some blood-curdling place like the legendary Sukhanov Monastery. It would not be a home for the aged, like Schlüsselburg. He would not be allowed to sit down in the daytime, not be allowed to speak for years on end. No one would ever hear of him, and he would know nothing about the world outside, even if whole continents changed their flags or people landed on the moon. And on the very last day, when the Stalin gang was rounded up for Nuremberg Mark II, Inakenti and his voiceless neighbours on the monastery corridor would be shot to a man in solitary, as the communists had shot people during the retreat of 1941 and the Nazis in 1945. But was he really afraid to die? Last night Inakenti had been glad of every little happening, every opening of the door to interrupt his solitude, and the unfamiliar feeling of being trapped. Now, though, all he wanted to do was to concentrate on formulating an idea that had so far proved elusive, and he was glad that they had brought him back to his old box and left him undisturbed for so long, though he was under continuous surveillance through the spy hole. Suddenly, it was as if a fine veil had been lifted from his brain, and words he had read and thought about yesterday stood out clearly. Belief in immortality was born of the greed of insatiable people. The wise man will find our allotted span long enough to make the round of all attainable pleasures. But pleasure was not what concerned him now. He had enjoyed money, fine clothes, esteem, women, wine, travel. But to hell with all that. Right now he longed for one thing only, justice. To live to see the end of that gang of crooks and hear their pathetic gibbering in the dock. Yes, he had enjoyed so many blessings. But the most precious of blessings had never been his. The freedom to say what you think, the freedom to associate openly with your intellectual equals. There must be so many of them, unknown to him by name or sight, behind the brick barriers of this building. It hurt him to think that he could not share their thoughts and feelings before he died. It was all very well philosophizing under shady boughs in stagnantly happy epochs. Now that he was without pencil and notebook, whatever floated up from the black hole of memory was all the more precious. He remembered vividly, "You should not fear physical suffering. Prolonged suffering is always insignificant. Significant suffering is of short duration. But what if you sit for a day and a night without sleep and without air in a box like this, where you can't straighten and stretch out your legs? Is that prolonged or unprolonged suffering? Significant or insignificant? Or 10 years in solitary, say, with never a living word?" In the room where photographs and fingerprints were taken, Inakenti had noticed that it was after 1 a.m. It might be after 2 by now. A foolish thought forced its way into his mind. His watch had been put in the storeroom. It would go on working until it ran down, then stop. Nobody would ever wind it again, and it would await its owner's death or confiscation, together with the rest of his property, with its hands in that position. What time, he wondered, would it be showing? Was Dottie still waiting for him to take her to the operetta? Had she called the ministry? Most probably not. They would have arrived to search the flat immediately. An enormous flat. It would take more than 5 men to turn it upside down overnight. And what was there for them to find, the idiots? Dottie won't go to jail. Our year apart will save her. She'll get a divorce and remarry. But who knows? They may jail her. Anything is possible in this country. My father-in-law's career will come to a halt, a black mark. I can hear him bellyaching now.
He has nothing to do with me, I tell you.
All those who have ever known Councillor Volodin will loyally expunge him from their memories. An insensate mass would crush him, and no one on this earth would ever know how puny milk and water in Akenti had tried to save civilization. He wanted to live, long enough to know how it would all end. In history, one side always wins. But never only one side's ideas. Ideas merge. They have a life of their own. The victor always borrows something, sometimes a lot, sometimes everything, from the vanquished. All things will merge. The enmity of race against race will be no more. State frontiers will disappear, and armies with them. A world parliament will be convened. A president of the planet will be elected. He will bare his head before mankind and say, "Bring your things." Eh? Bring your things. What things? Your gear. What do you think? Innocenti rose, holding his overcoat and cap, which were especially precious to him now, because they had not been ruined in the sterilizer. Around the door, shouldering the corridor man aside, came the smart, swarthy sergeant major. Where did they recruit these guardsmen? For what heavy duties? With the light blue epaulets, who consulted a piece of paper and asked,
"Name?"
"Volodin."
"First name and patronymic?"
"Innocenti Artemievich."
"Year of birth?"
1919.
"Place of birth?"
"Leningrad."
"Bring your things. Walk." He went ahead, clicking as prescribed. This time they went outside and in the dark, covered end of the yard, down a few more steps. Were they, he wondered, taking him to be shot? Execution by shooting, so people said, always took place in cellars, and always at night. His momentary anxiety was relieved by the thought that they would hardly have given him those receipts if they meant to shoot him. It wouldn't be just yet, anyway. Innocenti still believed that the Ministry of State Security's tentacles were cleverly coordinated. Still clicking his tongue, the dashing sergeant major conducted him into the building and through a dark lobby to an elevator. A woman with a pile of freshly ironed, yellowish-grey linen stood to one side and watched as Innocenti was installed in the elevator. This young washerwoman was unattractive, socially inferior, and looked at Innocenti with the same inscrutable, stony indifference as did all the other clockwork doll people in the Lyubyanka. But Innocenti felt just as he had in the presence of the storeroom girls who had presented him with receipts pink, blue, and white. Hurt that she should see him so stricken, so humiliated, and perhaps think of him with insulting compassion. This thought, too, vanished as quickly as it had come. Keep permanently. After that, nothing mattered. The sergeant major closed the door of the elevator and pressed the button. The numbers of the floors were not marked. The moment the elevator started moving, Innocenti recognized the humming of the mysterious machine he had heard grinding bones beyond the wall of his box. He smiled wanly. But he was glad to have been mistaken, and was somehow reassured. The elevator stopped. The sergeant major led Innocenti onto the landing and at once into a broad corridor, where he glimpsed many guards wearing blue epaulets with white bars. One of them locked Innocenti in an unnumbered box, a roomy one this time, about 10 square meters, dimly lit, with walls painted an unrelieved dark green. This box, or cell, was empty, looked not very clean, had a scuffed cement floor, and a chill in the air made it still more forbidding. There was the usual spy hole. Many pairs of boots could be heard shuffling past outside. Guards seemed to be continually coming and going. The inner prison had a busy nightlife. Innocenti had thought earlier that he would be permanently housed in narrow, overheated, blindingly lit box number 8, and had suffered agonies because there was no legroom. The light hurt his eyes and breathing was difficult. Now he realized his mistake, realized that he would be living in this big, uncomfortable, unnumbered box, and he was suffering in anticipation. The cement floor would be cold to his feet. The incessant shuffling out in the corridor would irritate him. The poor light would be depressing. What a difference a window would make. Even the littlest of windows. a window like those in prison vaults on the operatic stage. But there was not even that. The memoirs of émigrés would give you no idea of what it was like. The corridors, the stairways, the doors, doors, doors. The comings and goings of officers, sergeants, auxiliary staff. The great Lubyanka was teeming with life in the middle of the night, yet there was no longer a single prisoner in sight. You could not possibly meet someone like yourself, could not possibly hear an unofficial word, and even official ones were few and far between. It was as if the whole enormous ministry were going without its night's sleep just for your sake, exclusively preoccupied with you and your crime. During his first hours inside, a prisoner is at the mercy of a single murderous idea. The newcomer must be kept apart from other prisoners so that no one can encourage him, so that he feels in isolation the full weight of the brute force that sustains the whole many-tentacled apparatus. Innocenti felt more and more sorry for himself. His telephone call no longer seemed like a great feat that would be recorded in all histories of the 20th century, but instead a thoughtless and, worst of all, pointless suicidal act. He could still hear the arrogantly casual voice of the American attaché mispronouncing the Russian for, "Who are you?" "Idiot! Idiot!" He had probably not even informed the ambassador. It had all been in vain. What fools they were. Prosperity breeds idiots. There was room to walk about in this box, but, exhausted and demoralized by all the formalities, Innocenti felt too weak. He made two attempts, then sat down on the bench with his arms dangling. So many noble aspirations, locked away in these boxes, entombed within these walls, would remain unknown to posterity. Accursed country! All the bitter pills it swallowed were medicine only for others, never for itself. Other countries were luckier. Australia, for instance, tucked away at the back of beyond, getting along nicely without air raids, without five-year plans, without discipline. Why, oh why, had he set off in pursuit of the bomb thieves? He should have headed for Australia and stayed there as a private person. Today or tomorrow, Innocenti should have been flying to Paris, then on to New York. He imagined himself not just travelling abroad, but setting out within the next 24 hours, and his heart sank. He would never be free again. He could have vented his frustration with his bare fingernails on the walls of his cell. The opening of the door forestalled this breach of prison rules. Once again, his particulars were checked. Innocenti answered as if in his sleep, and he was ordered out with his things. He had felt a little chilly in the box, so his hat was on his head and his overcoat was draped over his shoulders. He tried to leave the box like that, not realizing that he could possibly have been carrying two loaded pistols or two daggers under his coat. He was ordered to slip his arms through the sleeves, and then put his bare hands behind his back. More tongue-clicking, as he was taken to the head of the stairs near the elevator, then downstairs. Innocenti's main concern in his present position might have been to memorize how many turns he took and how many steps there were between them, so that he could try to understand the layout of the prison when he had time. But he was by now so disoriented that he walked along absent-mindedly, not noticing how far down they had gone. Then, suddenly, another hefty guard emerged from yet another corridor to confront him, clicking just as insistently. The guard who had brought Innocenti tugged open the door of a green plywood booth, which blocked much of a smallest landing, bundled Innocenti in, and pulled the door closed behind himself. Inside there was just room to stand, and a diffused light filtered down from above. The booth evidently had no roof. Light found its way there from the stairwell. The normal human reaction would have been to protest loudly, but Innocenti, who was getting used to senseless harassment and the Lubyanka's monastic silences, was mutely compliant. In other words, behaved just as the prison required him to. Of course. That probably explained all the clicking. It was to warn people that a prisoner was being taken somewhere. One prisoner must not meet another, must not be heartened by the fellow feeling in his eyes. One man was led past, then another, and Innocenti was let out of the booth and taken farther. Only here, as he descended the last flight, did Innocenti notice how worn these steps were. He had never seen anything like it in his life. Between the two sides of each step there was an elliptical hollow, and at the midpoint the step was worn to half its original thickness. He shuddered. In 30 years how many feet, how many times, must have shuffled their way down to wear the stone away like that? And of every 2 walkers one would be a guard, the other a prisoner. On one landing there was a locked door with a ventilation panel shut tight behind a grating. Here a new trial awaited Innocenti. He was made to stand with his face to the wall. He could still see his escort out of the corner of his eye, pressing a button. An electric bell rang, and the panel cautiously opened, then closed again. A key turned noisily in the lock. The door opened. Someone came out and, unseen by Innocenti, began questioning him. Name? Innocenti naturally looked around, as people usually do when they speak to each other, and saw a face that was neither masculine nor feminine, a flabby, boneless face with a big red scald mark, and lower down a lieutenant's golden epaulets. Pausing only to yell, "No turning around!" the man reeled off the sickeningly familiar questions, and Innocenti addressed his answers to the patch of white plaster in front of him. Having verified that the prisoner still claimed to be the person designated on the card, and still remembered the year and place of his birth, the flabby lieutenant rang the doorbell himself. The door had been locked behind him for safety. The panel slid open cautiously once more. Someone looked through the aperture. The panel was closed. The key turned noisily in the lock, and the door opened.
"Walk!"
the flabby lieutenant with the red scald mark said sharply. They stepped inside, and the door was noisily locked behind them. Ahead, a gloomy corridor branched out in 3 directions. It had several doors, and to the left, by the entrance, stood a desk, pigeonholes, and still more guards. Innocenti caught no more than a glimpse of all this before the lieutenant's voice, subdued but clearly audible in this hushed place, commanded,
"Face the wall! Don't move!"
A ludicrous situation to be in. Staring closely at the border between dark green panelling and white plaster, all the time feeling several pairs of hostile eyes on the back of your head. They were obviously consulting his index card. The lieutenant then ordered, almost in a whisper, but quite audibly in the profound silence,
"Third box."
A guard detached himself from the desk, and, careful not to jingle his keys, set off along the strip of carpet in the right-hand corridor.
"Hands behind. Walk,"
he said very quietly. On one side of their path, the same dark olive-green wall wound around 3 turns. On the other side, they passed several doors, bearing highly polished oval number plates, 47, 48, 49, and beneath them, lids over the spy holes. Warmed by the feeling that friends were so near, Innocenti felt an urge to disturb the lid over one of the spy holes, put his eye to it for a moment, and take a look at the secluded life of the cell. But the guard drew him briskly on, and anyway, Innocenti was already inured to prison discipline, though it was difficult to see what a man who had joined the battle over the atom bomb still had to fear. Fortunately for governments, mere humans, unfortunately for them, are so constructed that as long as they live, there is always something to take away from them. Even a man imprisoned for life, deprived of movement, of the sight of the sky, deprived of a family and property, can be transferred to a damp punishment cell, denied hot food and beaten with canes. And these minor punishments are just as keenly felt as his earlier dislodgement from the peak of freedom and prosperity. It is to avoid these vexatious later punishments that a prisoner duly complies with abhorrent and degrading prison regulations that gradually destroy his humanity. The doors around the next turn were closed together, and the glazed discs bore the numbers 1, 2, 3. The guard unlocked the door of the 3rd box and, with a hospitable flourish that looked rather comical in the circumstances, held it wide open for Innocenti. Innocenti noticed the humorous touch and looked closely at the guard. He was a short young man with smooth black hair and slant eyes like oblique saber cuts. He looked unfriendly. His lips and eyes alike were unsmiling. But, after all the dozens of impassively bianca faces seen that night, the mean face of this last guard was somehow rather likeable. Locked in his box, Innocenti took a look around. He had been able to compare several boxes in the course of the night and could consider himself an expert. This box was heavenly. 3.5 steps wide, 7.5 long, with a parquet floor. A long and fairly wide wooden bench built into the wall almost filled the cell, and there was a small, freestanding, hexagonal wooden table near the door. The box, of course, was windowless, with just a black grill for ventilation high up in the wall. The box was also very high, 3.5 meters of wall, every meter of it whitewashed, and reflecting the glare from a 200-watt bulb in a wire cover over the door. The light warmed the box, but hurt the eyes. Prison skills are soon learned and not easily forgotten. This time, Innocenti did not delude himself. He had no hope of staying long in this comfortable box. He realized as soon as he saw the bench, a long, hard bench, for the mollycoddled Innocenti was toughening up by the hour, that his first and most important object now must be to get some sleep. And, just as a young animal, uninstructed by its mother, is taught by the promptings of its own nature all the skills it needs to survive. So Innocenti quickly contrived to spread his overcoat over the bench and bundle the astrakhan collar and rolled-up sleeves together to serve as a pillow. He lay down immediately. It felt very comfortable. He shut his eyes and got ready to sleep. But he could not get to sleep. He had so longed to sleep when there was no possibility of it. He had gone through all the stages of tiredness and twice lost consciousness, dozing off for a single second, and now, when sleep suddenly was a possibility, he could not sleep. Whenever his overstrained nerves seemed about to relax, they suddenly became as tense as ever. Fighting off forebodings, regrets, and speculations, Innocenti tried breathing rhythmically and counting. It was most annoying not being able to sleep when his whole body was warm, his ribs were on a level surface, his legs were stretched out full length, and the guard, for some reason, was not keeping him awake. He lay that way for about half an hour. His thoughts were finally becoming incoherent, and a drowsy warmth was stealing over him from his feet upward. But suddenly Innocenti felt that he could not possibly go to sleep with that insanely bright light in the cell. The light not only filtered through his closed eyelids in an orange glare, it pressed upon his eyeballs. The pressure of light, which Innocenti had never noticed before, was now driving him to distraction. Tossing and turning in the vain hope of finding a position where the light would not be oppressive, Innocenti finally sat up and lowered his legs from the bench. He had repeatedly heard the faint sound as the cover was displaced from the spy hole. Next time it was moved, he quickly raised a finger. The door opened noiselessly. The squint-eyed guard looked at Innocenti without speaking. "Please, please, switch off the light," Innocenti implored.
"Not allowed,"
the squint-eyed one answered calmly.
"Change the bulb, then. Put in a dimmer one. Why such a bright bulb for such a small box?"
"Don't speak so loudly,"
Squint-Eyes said very quietly. Behind him, the main corridor and the whole prison were indeed silent as the grave. The light is as ordered, and yet there was some slight sign of life in this dead face. Left with nothing to say and expecting the door to close at any moment, Innocenti asked for a drink of water. Squint-Eyes nodded and locked the door noiselessly. Innocenti did not hear him walking away or returning along the strip of carpet outside the box. There was just a little jingle as the key was inserted, and Squint-Eyes stood in the doorway with a mug of water. Like those on the ground floor of the prison, the mug was decorated with a picture of a cat, but this one was without spectacles, book, or bird. Innocenti drank heartily and, in between swallows, took a look at the guard still standing there. Keeping one foot outside, he half-closed the door, leaving just room for his shoulders, and, with a distinctly non-regulation wink, asked in a low voice,
"Who were you?"
How strange it sounded, being addressed like a human being for the first time that night.
The natural tone of voice in which the question was asked, quietly, so that the man's superiors could not overhear it, and the unintentionally cruel word "were," seemed to involve Innocenti in a sort of conspiracy with the guard.
"Diplomat,"
he whispered.
"State counselor."
Squint-Eyes nodded sympathetically and said,
Well, I was a sailor once. Baltic Fleet.
Then, after some hesitation,
what are you in for?
I don't know myself,
Innocenti said cautiously.
For no particular reason.
Squint Eyes nodded sympathetically.
That's what they all say to start with,
he said, and added coarsely.
Want to go for a you-know-what?
Not just yet, Innocenti said. The unenlightened newcomer did not know that the offer made to him was the greatest favour in the power of a guard to give, and one of the greatest blessings on earth, normally accessible to prisoners only at prescribed times. After this absorbing conversation, the door closed, and Innocenti stretched out on the bench again, trying in vain to escape the pressure of the light through his unprotected eyes. He tried covering his eyes with one hand, but the hand became numb. It occurred to him that it would help a lot if he twisted his handkerchief into a sort of blindfold, but where was it? It had remained on the floor, where it had fallen. What a stupid young pup he had been last night! Such small items as a handkerchief, an empty matchbox, a bit of coarse thread, a plastic button, are the prisoner's best friends. He never knows when one or another of them may become indispensable and save the day. Suddenly the door opened, and Squint Eyes transferred a red-striped, quilted mattress from his own embrace to Innocenti's.
A miracle!
The Lubyanka not only not preventing a prisoner from sleeping, but doing its best to help him. Tucked inside the doubled-up mattress were a little feather pillow, a pillowcase, and a sheet. The last two stamped, inner prison, and even a grey blanket.
What bliss! Now he'd be able to sleep!
His first impressions of prison had been too gloomy. Enjoying his comfort in anticipation, and doing it with his own hands for the first time in his life, he pulled the pillowcase over the pillow, spread the sheet over the bench, which was so narrow that the mattress dropped over the edge, undressed, lay down, covered his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket, and nothing could stop him now, was just beginning to sink into a sweet sleep in the arms of Morpheus, as they say when suddenly the door crashed open and Squint Eyes said, "Take your hands from under the blanket!"
"What for?"
Innocenti exclaimed, almost weeping.
"Why did you wake me up? I had such difficulty getting to sleep."
"Get your hands out," the guard repeated, unmoved. "Hands must be out in the open." Innocenti obeyed, but it proved to be not so easy to fall asleep with his hands above the blanket.
This was diabolically clever.
Human beings, without even noticing it, have an inveterate habit of concealing their hands, pressing them to their bodies while they sleep. Innocenti tossed and turned, trying to adapt himself to yet another cruel humiliation. At last, sleep began to get the upper hand. A sweetly toxic mist was flooding his consciousness. Suddenly a noise in the corridor reached his ears. Beginning at a distance, and gradually drawing nearer, they were banging neighbouring doors. Some word or other accompanied every bang. Now they were next door, and now Innocenti's own door opened.
"Time to get up,"
the man who had served with the Baltic Fleet announced uncompromisingly.
"What? Why?" Innocenti bellowed. "I haven't slept all night."
6 o'clock, getting up time.
"It's the law,"
the sailor repeated, and walked on to deliver his message to others. And this was when Innocenti felt a more powerful need than ever to sleep. He collapsed on his bed and immediately lost consciousness. But right away, he couldn't have managed more than a couple of minutes' sleep. Squint Eyes flung the door open with a crash and repeated,
"Time to get up! Time to get up! Roll your mattress up!"
Innocenti raised himself on one elbow and looked blearily at his tormentor, who just an hour ago had seemed so amiable.
"But I haven't slept, I tell you.
That's not my business."
"Right, I roll my mattress up. I get up. And what do I do next?"
"Nothing. Sit."
"But why?"
"Because it's 6 a.m. You've been told."
"So I'll sleep sitting up."
"I'll see you don't. I'll wake you up." Innocenti held his head in his hands and rocked from side to side. What looked like a glimmer of compassion showed in the squint-eyed guard's face. "You want a wash?"
"Oh, all right,"
Innocenti said absently, reaching for his clothes. "Hands behind. Walk." The washroom was around a bend. Despairing of getting any sleep that night, Innocenti risked removing his shirt and washing in cold water down to his waist. He splashed water freely on the wide cement floor of the chilly washroom. The door was shut, and squint eyes did not disturb him. Perhaps he is human, Innocenti thought. But if so, why did he so perfidiously fail to warn me that Revali would be at 6? The cold water rinsed the debilitating poison of a broken sleep out of Innocenti's system. In the corridor he started saying something about breakfast, but the guard cut him short. Back in the box, he gave his answer. There won't be any breakfast.
No breakfast? So what will there be?
At 8 o'clock you get your ration, sugar and tea.
What do you mean, ration?
Bread, of course.
So when is breakfast?
Nothing about that in regulations. Right through to dinner.
And I've got to be sitting here all that time.
That's enough talk. Innocenti quickly raised his hand when the door was very nearly closed. Now what? The veteran of the Baltic Fleet said, opening the door wide.
My lining's been ripped open and my buttons cut off. Can I get somebody to sew them back on?
How many buttons? They counted. The door was locked and unlocked again shortly afterward. Squint Eyes held out a needle, a dozen or so lengths of thread, and a few buttons of different sizes and materials, bone, plastic, wood.
What good are these? Do you think the ones they cut off were like these?
Take them. They're about all we've got, Squint Eyes said, raising his voice. And Innocenti began sewing for the first time in his life. It took him a little while to find out how to knot the thread at one end, how to draw the stitches through, and how to make sure the button was firmly attached. Not having a millennium of human experience to draw on, Innocenti discovered for himself how to sew. He pricked himself repeatedly, and his tender fingertips began to hurt. It took him a long time to sew up the lining of his uniform and stuff the padding back into his gutted overcoat. He had sewn on some of the buttons in the wrong places, so that his uniform was puckered at the edges. But this unhurried, painstaking labour not only killed time, it calmed Innocenti down completely. He no longer felt afraid or despondent. Clearly, even this nest of legendary horrors, the great Lyubyanka prison, was not so terrible. People could live even here. How he wished that he could meet them. This man, who had not slept all night and had not eaten, this man whose life had been shattered in a few hours, had risen above it all. He was like an athlete whose stiffening body becomes fresh and tireless again with his second wind. A guard, a different one this time, took away the needle. Then they brought a 500-gram lump of half-baked black bread, with a triangular make-weight and 2 lumps of sugar. A little later they poured some hot, coloured liquid into the mug with the cat and promised a refill. All of which meant that it was 8 a.m. on December the 27th. Innocenti dropped the whole day's sugar ration into the mug and unfastidiously tried to stir it with his finger, but the tea was too hot. He stirred it by revolving the mug, drank with relish, he felt no need for food at all, and raised his hand to ask for more. Shivering with pleasure, Innocenti imbibed the second mugful too. There was no sugar this time, but he enjoyed all the more keenly the acrid aroma of stale tea. Suddenly, he was thinking more clearly than he had for a long time past. In the narrow passage between the bench and the opposite wall, gripping the rolled-up mattress, he began pacing as if warming up for a fight. 3 short steps forward, 3 short steps back. He would have done no other. He could not have remained indifferent. It had fallen to him to do it. What was it Uncle Avenir had said? How did Herzen put it? Where are the limits of patriotism? Why does a man love his motherland? Nothing was more important to him now, nothing more cheering than his memories of old Avenir. He had met so many men and women frequently, year after year, made friends of them, shared their pleasures. But it was the old man at Tver, with the funny little house, whom he had seen only for 2 days, who meant most to him here in the Lyubyanka. No one in his life had ever been so important to him. Slowly pacing his cul-de-sac, 7 steps there, 7 steps back, Innocenti tried to remember what the old man had said. It was at the back of his mind. But for some reason, what came uppermost was, Our inner feelings of satisfaction and dissatisfaction are the highest criteria of good and evil. That wasn't his uncle. That was something stupid. Of course, Epicurus. He hadn't understood it yesterday. Now it was clear. Whatever gives me pleasure is good. Whatever displeases me is bad. Stalin, for instance, enjoyed killing people, so that, for him, was good. Whereas we who are imprisoned for the truth get no satisfaction from it. So is that evil? How wise it all seems when you read these philosophers as a free man. But for Innocenti, good and evil were now distinct entities, visibly separated by that light grey door, those olive-green walls, and that first night in prison. His struggle and his suffering had raised him to a height from which the great materialist's wisdom seemed like the prattle of a child, or perhaps a savage's rule of thumb. The door opened noisily.
"Name!"
barked a new guard, of Asiatic appearance.
"Volodin."
"Interrogation! Hands behind!"
Innocenti put his hands behind him, and, with his head thrown back like a bird swallowing water, walked out of the box. Why must love of country extend to...